This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just because Facebook isn't already everywhere, yes, I know, now they're going to start doing search from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 15th of January. Good as always to have you with us. This news today from Facebook World Headquarters in Menlo Park, California. The search box on the social networking site is now finally going to be good for something. Just what it's going to be good for, though, is still kind of up in the air, which is why we've got our technology reporter, Quina Kim, here to explain the big announcement. She was at Facebook today. Hey, Quina, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So listen, I'm going to play you a piece of tape from the man himself, Mark Zuckerberg, and then I'm going to need some help. Here you go.
Graph search is not web search, is the first thing that I want to start off with. We're not indexing the web here. We're indexing our map of the graph.
Okay, graph search. I don't even know what that means.
I know. Basically, what he's saying is Facebook is going to have search within Facebook. They're not going to go after the whole web in the way Google does and index all that information. They're just going to index the information that they have. And right now, it's limited to a few categories. It's people, photos, places, and interests. But here's how it works. So let's say I meet somebody interesting at your party, Kai, but yeah. I only get their first name, George, and that they went to Berkeley. I don't know that much about them. Well, if we're friends, then I can just put in George, Kai, and his name should pop up.
This is them using their enormous trove of data, right?
Correct. You know, you can go on Yelp to find the best restaurant, but how cool it be if you're like Chinese restaurant in San Francisco and all your friends, all the ones that they've liked come up.
So if I work at Google today, and obviously, you know, I'm watching this going on down the road, whatever, am I worried? I mean, is this Facebook's first foray into a potentially wider search engine?
Yes. I think you're not worried right now because, as Zuckerberg said over and over again, this is a beta. But, you know, the thing about Facebook is it has all this data, billion users, that's totally a blind spot for Google. And as Google gets more into things, as we've been seeing, like they're getting into restaurant reviews, they're getting into shopping and whatnot. This is all the sort of personal information they can't access. So Google always tries to make sure that they've got the search for you. Well, Facebook, if they're successful, can take it even further and make it really connect to you and your friends.
What about privacy, Quina? I mean, that's been Facebook's big weakness the whole time. Can I search for anybody, anywhere, anytime, and just find them?
Well, this is obviously on their minds because they took a little time out to walk us through it. They've created more of these sort of like filters. So let's say you have photos out there and you can see all the photos of yourself. You can untag yourself, and you could also even request that Facebook takes off photos so you don't make them searchable to your friends.
So I would have to go in there and untag myself, right? But if I don't do that, then somebody random out there can find me on Facebook and, you know, looking for radio people in Los Angeles, whatever.
Right. All those embarrassing pictures that your mom or your sister or brother are posting, they're going to pop up.
That's right. Quina Kim on the latest from Facebook today. Quina, thanks a bunch.
Great. Thank you.
All right. From search to ads we go. Coca-Cola started running a new ad campaign this week, and it's safe to say those ads are quite a bit different from what Coke has run before. The biggest soft drink company on the planet has a new anti-obesity message. Coke is emphasizing its low-calorie drinks and showing you all the fun ways you can burn off the 140 calories that there are in a can of the stuff. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more now on marketing as a solution for obesity.
The first ad opens with vintage clips of old Coca-Cola commercials. A soothing voiceover reminds us of Coca-Cola's 125-year history of bringing people together.
Today, we'd like people to come together on something that concerns all of us, obesity.
The problem with this ad, Tom Perko says, is that it's not going to make people choose healthier drinks.
Ads are great and they can be entertaining and informative, but essentially they don't change the nature of consumption.
Perko is a consultant to the beverage industry. In other words, advertisements don't necessarily dig deeply into our consciousness and change our behavior.
We have ad agency clients know they hate it when I say that to them.
But Perko says, this isn't really about selling low-calorie products.
We're dealing here with almost an existential issue. Coca-Cola has to be seen to be the good guy. And it's not a matter of admitting guilt or saying that it's doing something wrong with a new ad campaign. All it really doing is reaffirming that it's with us.
The ad also emphasizes low-calorie and zero-calorie soft drinks as healthy alternatives. This concerns nutritionist Jennifer Cassetta.
As a clinical nutritionist and holistic nutritionist, I don't believe in those either. I don't think that's the solution.
Coke has its own long history with diet drinks. This May is the 50th anniversary of Tab, a soft drink co-created for customers who want to keep tabs on their weight. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Man, you remember Tab? That seems like so long ago. All right, anyway, something like 150,000 school kids in New York City are going to be looking for a different way to get to school tomorrow. Bus drivers in the country's biggest school system are set to go out on strike. Students will be able to ride public transit for free, or if they have to take a cab, the city will pay for it. But parents in New York aren't the only ones following the strike news. School bus drivers in Charleston, South Carolina are also talking about walking out. From the education desk at WYPR, Amy Scott takes a look at the job of getting the kids to school on time.
If the strike happens in New York, more than 8,000 school bus drivers and matrons will walk off the job tomorrow. Matrons help kids get on and off the bus safely. Though the city will pay for other arrangements, some parents may keep their kids at home.
As a result, a lot of people would be forced to not make it into work, and a strike would have a ripple effect throughout the economy in the city.
Gary Chason grew up in New York taking the bus to school. He now teaches labor relations at Clark University. New York City is trying to save money, so it's put some of its bus contracts up for a competitive bid. Union drivers want guarantees they'll keep their jobs. Chason says organized labor has been trying to rebuild its reputation as good for the economy. This won't help.
People will see images of children waiting for buses that never show up and parents missing work because there were no buses for their kids.
New York drivers aren't the only unhappy ones. Today, school bus drivers in Charleston, South Carolina, voted to authorize a strike. They're concerned about wages and health benefits and about safety.
I would say I was breaking down on the average about every other month. So, yes, that is a concern.
That's retired Charleston County school bus driver Jim Merriman. He says he made $12 to $13 an hour, better than a lot of blue-collar jobs in the area. And there were other perks.
The reward just of seeing kids every day was what really made me do it.
Getting up at 5:30 every morning, not so rewarding. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Traders didn't need a graph or a search or anything at all to know how they felt about the Facebook news. Didn't like it much. Shares off more than 2.5%. The major indices were split. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Should you find yourself in the market for a new pair of glasses, reading, bifocals, distance, sun, what have you, there's no shortage of choices. You could go to Lens Crafters or Pearle Vision, maybe pick out a new pair of Ray-Bans or Oliver Peoples, and then you might want to check the price tag because a new set of frames alone could easily set you back more than $300. That's in some part because the choice I was talking about really isn't. All those brands that I mentioned are owned by a single company called Luxottica, which also happens to own Sunglass Hut in Oakley. But there are changes coming to the somewhat buttoned-down eyeglasses industry thanks to an upstart firm named Warby Parker. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has that story.
Let me just start by saying that Warby Parker sells a monocle. Yes, mostly ironically, but this is a company that appeals to hipster types who may or may not have handlebar mustaches. Its frames tend to be thick-rimmed, like something Buddy Holly wore. Its name comes from Jack Kerouac characters, But there's nothing niche about Warby Parker's ambition.
It didn't make sense that glasses should cost as much as an iPhone.
Neil Blumenthal founded Warby Parker in 2010 with a few Wharton Business School friends who were frustrated by the high cost of frames. Their answer? High-quality glasses for $95, including lenses. Warby Parker designs the frames itself and sells online, undercutting established brands that mark up prices up to 20 times more than the cost. It's a formula co-founder David Gilboa hopes will do to Luxottica what Amazon has done to bookstores.
Yeah, I think Luxottica has done a great job of creating the illusion of choice.
A Luxottica spokesperson declined to comment. While there are a number of eyewear companies, Luxottica is the biggest player, with about 30% of the U.S. market, according to IBIS World. Luke Williams of the Stern School of Business at NYU says Warby Parker is trying to upend an industry that many didn't think was broken.
Well, it's very daring.
Warby Parker glasses aren't available in many bricks-and-mortar shops. Instead, it has a home trial program, shipping up to 5 frames for free.
They're basically bringing the store to you.
To hone its image, the founders set up shop in Soho, New York's capital of fashion. Its open office is research and design, marketing, and a call center all in one.
Hello, Warby Parker.
The company has grown to nearly 130 employees and has raised $55 million in venture capital from big names like Ashton Kutcher. It's not yet profitable, but it's sold at least a few hundred thousand frames and is growing fast, though it's still a tiny player in a $9 billion retail market. Christopher Marquis of Harvard Business School thinks Warby Parker could challenge entrenched companies.
Warby Parker, by actually, you know, combining sort of high fashion with reasonable price, offers a much more potent threat to these other companies like Luxottica.
Casey Ifini, a grad student, recently ditched his Ray-Bans. For less than the cost of that Luxottica frame, he's bought 3 Warby Parkers.
Once I saw the style of the frames and once I saw that they were, you know, $95, I was like, okay, this could really work.
One way to know if Warby Parker is changing the eyewear business is if a company like Luxottica copies the model. And that's a big risk for Warby, says Williams of NYU.
Now, when that happens, Warby Parker are going to have to disrupt the model again.
And Warby Parker plans to take on bricks and mortar stores soon, opening a showroom in Soho this year, right across from the Apple Store. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Coming up, a new-ish way to fight piracy.
We are the first of its kind for 200 years. And yes, the clock is going back.
Privateers, anyone? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 27 points today, 0.2%, closed at 13,534. The NASDAQ lost 6 points, also 0.2%, ended at 3110. The S&P 500 added 0.1%. Finished at 1472. Shoppers spent more in December than predicted, the Commerce Department reported today, and thus retail stocks celebrated. Express jumped nearly 24% after reporting better than expected holiday sales. Abercrombie & Fitch dressed up 2.8%. The Limited and Macy's added about 2% apiece. Lennar, the home builder, reported a 40% increase in revenue as new home orders kept growing. Its shares fell 0.7%. And yes, how many more bites of the apple will the market take? The company's shares lost 3% more today, closed down below $500 a piece for the first time since last February. You're listening to Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve releases the first beige book of 2013. It summarizes current economic conditions. Did you buy stuff on eBay? Sell stuff on eBay? The company reports quarterly earnings. And on January 16, 1919, the 18th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, banning the manufacture, sale, or transportation of booze. Prohibition went into effect a year later. It was the law, and everyone obeyed it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The unemployment rate for veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan last month was 10.8%. That's 3 full percentage points above the national average. Walmart said today it wants to help do something about that. It's going to hire 100,000 veterans over the next 5 years. Any veteran who wants a job, in fact. But the fact is, a lot of service members returning home can't even get a job. Kurt Ron runs a human resources and recruiting firm in Atlanta. It's called HR Works. Mr. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Guy.
Why is it so hard for veterans to find a job these days? I mean, it's great that Walmart's going to hire 100,000 of them, but that's not going to do it, is it?
Kai, it's a much more complex issue than simply hiring 100,000 people. Unemployment is extremely high. There's a lot of people competing for the jobs. So someone has to make a decision to hire a vet.
How much of it, though, is well, there are a couple of questions, actually, that came to mind this morning when we talked about this. The first is, how much is a misunderstanding of the skill set? I mean, if somebody gets out of the Navy with, you know, 12 years of service and he has on his resume, I was a bosun's mate first class, you know, somebody working at Walmart or any place else, for that matter, in a hiring job, isn't going to know what that means.
I think that's very true. So, for instance, in a Walmart kind of situation, someone that's a chief warrant officer, a chief warrant officer could be an operations manager at a Walmart store.
In a heartbeat, right?
Absolutely. They've been managing a budget. They've been managing a team of people. They're mission driven. They're delivering results. Your question, you know, so why not the vet? Well, if I'm hiring an operations manager for a big box store, as a hiring manager, I probably want somebody that has 7 to 10 years experience as an operations manager in a big box store. You really have to probably have been a vet with a desire to hire a vet to take the risk to hire the chief warrant officer, even though you and I believe they'd do great.
Is there, and this is a little touchy, I guess, is there a stigma now with some of these folks coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, there's PTSD in the news. These might not be the easiest hires if somebody has to go for treatment once a month or whatever?
There certainly is concern. When you talk to someone about hiring a vet, the reality is we need to do something, and employers need to make a choice. And if that means someone has to spend, you know, a day a month with a doctor or going to an appointment or going to the VA, then so be it. I might go to the dentist. The other thing is that when it doesn't work out, well, we can't hire vets. They have PTSD. It didn't work out. The reason Walmart hires a couple hundred thousand people a year is because it doesn't work out, right? It's not an isolated case. It's not a vet and PTSD. Every employee doesn't become a lifetime employee. So I think there's a complexity, and to your point, people have a concern surrounding this, so maybe they don't act.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you think there will be a trickle-down effect? I mean, what's your guess as to whether or not other companies now, I mean, Walmart, the biggest retailer on the planet, is doing this. Is there going to be a trickle-down effect to other companies that might finally do something about veteran unemployment?
It certainly raises awareness. But, Kai, you and I both know that people have been talking about veteran employment for years. You want to hire 100,000 vets. Are they going to be going out to the transition offices and talking to the transition offices? How are they going to get to these people so that there really is a seated pool? You know, if we want to fish in a pond, we want to fish where there are fish. So there's a question of making it a priority, but it's as simple as hire one. That's what I tell everybody. If you could just hire one vet, it makes a difference.
Kurt Ron is the president of the Atlanta-based recruiting firm HR Works. We talked to him out of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Mr. Ron, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
The world's richest man wants to give everybody in Mexico, everybody in the Spanish-speaking world, actually, something for free, an education. Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim is paying to translate thousands of online educational videos into Spanish. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
The Khan Academy is a nonprofit organization that makes free educational videos like this one.
Here you have a finite area. You can imagine the surface of a balloon or the surface of a bubble. Or
the Carlos Slim Foundation is paying to translate them into Spanish.
En ese tipo de esfera se tiene un área finita.
Most of the 3,000-plus videos focus on math and science, but that could change. Shantanu Sinha is president of the Khan Academy.
One of the things that Carlos Slim and the foundation is interested in is bringing that to more diverse fields, including more vocational type of fields in Mexico and more job-related fields.
This comes when Mexico's government is debating how to reform the educational system. As it stands, the country does a good job of teaching literacy, but not so great in terms of turning out a workforce ready to compete on the global stage. Andrew Seeley is with the Woodrow Wilson Center.
It's particularly difficult when you get outside of major metropolitan areas to get an outstanding education that would take you to a top college and maybe to an international graduate program.
He says online videos have the potential to democratize education.
Most young people, particularly ambitious young people who are looking to further their education, do find ways of getting some sort of internet connection for at least part of the day.
But connecting poor kids to the web remains a hurdle. To that end, the Slim Foundation is spending $315 million to expand access to the internet in Mexico. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace. There's a report coming out tomorrow on piracy in the Indian Ocean. The annual report of the International Maritime Bureau will be of interest to various navies around the world that have spent time and money trying to crack down on Somali pirates. Best evidence is that the number of pirate attacks has, in fact, declined. But getting there hasn't been cheap, and there has been talk about scaling things back. So a British entrepreneur has come up with a new take on an old idea, a private navy, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Somali pirates seem a world away from the Treasure Island image of buccaneering.
Oh, and a bottle of rum.
Give me a full one, George.
The traditional rum-swigging villains with a wooden leg, an eye patch and a parrot seem far removed from the bandits armed with Kalashnikovs that plague the Indian Ocean today. But Anthony Sharp is going back in time with his plan to scupper the Somali pirates. He's planning a private navy.
We are the first of its kind for 200 years. And yes, the clock is going back.
Back to the 18th century, when privateers were often used to keep the pirates at bay.
Midships, port 10.
Now Sharp's company, Typhon, is offering oil tankers and cargo vessels something similar. Instead of putting armed guards on each merchant vessel, he'll supply an armed naval escort.
We put our clients' ships into convoy, put an exclusion zone around that convoy, and protect that exclusion zone.
Typhon will use up to 10 motherships, each one crewed by 60 armed sailors equipped with high-speed patrol boats. Sharp argues that this will be far more efficient than deploying billion-dollar warships. Tom Patterson is with consulting firm Control Risks. He agrees that the national navies have set themselves an impossible task, patrolling the Indian Ocean.
Some commentators have likened it to patrolling the entirety of Western Europe with six patrol cars. Others have suggested it's like patrolling the US-Canada border with a scooter.
But the Piracy Reporting Centre in Kuala Lumpur points out that the International Naval Task Force and the presence of armed security guards on some merchant vessels have proved highly effective. Pirate attacks off the Horn of Africa have fallen by two-thirds. Some argue that a private naval security force, like Typhon, will never replace a proper navy.
The navies are able to do some things which no private armed security can do.
Captain Pottingal Mukundan of the International Maritime Bureau.
They can remove the equipment that they use to board the ships. They can remove weapons. They can detain. Navies can detain the pirates and then hand them over for prosecution. These are the real deterrents on piracy.
And here's another lesson from British history. When piracy proved most troublesome back in the 18th century, the Royal Navy sent its own gunships to sweep the riffraff off the high seas.
Clap him in irons! Clap him in irons!
A private navy is all well and good, says Captain Mukundan, but only a national navy can rule the waves. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So Facebook has graph search now, as we talked about up at the top of the broadcast, and they will surely figure out a way to make money off it sooner or later, because that's what you do with search on the web, after all. But commentator Nicholas Carr wonders whether maybe we've all started thinking about search the wrong way.
When we talk about searching these days, we're almost always talking about using Google to find something online. That's a big change for a word that long carried existential connotations, a word that had been bound up in our sense of what it meant to be human. We didn't just search for car keys or missing socks. We searched for truth, for meaning, for transcendence. Searching was an act of exploration that took us out into the world, beyond ourselves, in order to know the world and ourselves more fully. In its original form, the Google search engine did something like that. It transported us out into a messy and confusing world, the world of the web, with the intent of helping us make sense of it. But that's less true now. Google's big goal is no longer to read the web, it's to read us. Last month, the company hired Ray Kurzweil, an artificial intelligence expert, as its director of research. In the future, he says, Google will know so much about you that it will be able to deliver information before you even ask for it. You won't need to search at all. That future is already taking shape. You can see it in the personalized search results Google provides based on your earlier searches. And you can see it in a new Android app called Google Now. It tracks your location and uses prediction algorithms to deliver useful information to your smartphone preemptively. These days, Google's search engine doesn't push us outward so much as turn us inward. It gives us information that fits the pattern of behavior and thinking we've displayed in the past. It reinforces our biases rather than challenging them, and subverts the act of searching in its most meaningful sense. There was a time when search engines opened new vistas for us. Now they hold up a mirror to us, giving us back a reflection of ourselves. Search has become a tool for self-absorption.
Nicholas Carr's most recent book is called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. We're online if you want to search for us. Marketplace.org is the website.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, there was yet another claim this week from yet another convicted mobster that he is certain he knows where Jimmy Hoffa's body is buried. In a Michigan field, apparently, some 20 miles from where Hoffa was last seen back in 1975. The former Teamsters president is widely believed to have been killed by the mob, as you know, but proving that could cost a whole lot. The feds spent $225,000 digging up a barn looking for Hoffa back in 2006. That's according to DOJ records. And that also does not include the salaries or travel costs of the FBI agents who participated in that particular project. And yes, no, they did not find him. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM this Tuesday. Today, the Dow up 27 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 6 points, also 0.2%. The S&P 500 added just a point. That is a 0.1%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.